extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Wow. From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire from the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, David Goss, Kaylin Carr, Matt Doyle. I am refreshed. I am happy to be in my basement. I am happy to be in the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios. I'm exhausted, and we're only going to get more tired as this season goes on. It's wonderful. It's insane, but, man, it is a
Why
lot.
Are you so exhausted?
We had Heineken Rivalry Week.
And then, I thought it was all those 6:30 a.m. tea times.
It was 6:20. It was 6:20. I'm hurting myself in that sense, too. But it's Rivalry Week, into All-Star, into Rivalry Week, into World Cup qualifying, into the stretch run for the playoffs after we've already done everything that's been done up till now. I'm not complaining. I'm excited about it.
Into Cabo San Lucas?
Yeah, into Cabo San Lucas. Into 2 weeks in Cabo San Lucas.
Into parenting two children. Did you know I'm a father?
Wow.
Actually, one of those children's not even here, and I'm still tired. I have no excuses. Something's wrong with me. I don't know what it is. How you guys feeling?
Feel great. Feel energized, especially after that open, especially after that intro.
I feel a little overwhelmed. I'm not going to lie to you, just because of everything you listed off, right? Going from, you know, the summer full of international tournaments, and then we have Leagues Cup, and we have All-Star Game, and we have the regular season, which
you named
course,
Leagues Cup immediately. I knew there was something in here that was a little bit extra that was really sapping me emotionally, and it certainly is Leagues Cup.
But the big thing is that we're on the verge of World Cup qualifying, and everything that has happened in U.S. soccer over the past 4 years has been tainted one way or another, either to one degree or another, I should say, by what happened in Cuba 4 years ago. And we're 4 days away from reopening that old wound, perhaps, or maybe starting to heal a little bit. And so to have the sprint, the it was like a 5 mile sprint or a marathon length sprint that was this summer, and then end it with the emotional battering that is World Cup qualifying. And I'm saying this as a US fan.
Yeah,
imagine how Canadians feel right now. Because, like, if you think about the psychological trauma that U.S. fans suffered because of Cuba, Canadian fans have been suffering that for 35 years. So, like, I'm amped for this week. I'm also, like, deeply miserable right now because of what's to come.
Oh my God, Kaylin, you have a seed of positivity to plant in this soil before we get started
cautiously
on what is going to be an amazingly
cautiously pessimistic
uplifting show. Yeah,
I was like, oh gosh, things got dark there for a second with Doyle. It's like comparing traumas, and then as a Dynamo former player, I mean, the last 15 straight. I don't know if we want to just immediately sink deeper into that hole, but I'll just
Kaylin, don't worry, you can hang your hat on Chicago Fire.
Yeah, we're on the rise. Goss, back off, dude.
Long throw FC.
Anyways, All-Star was. I'm gonna celebrate the All-Star looked super fun. It was great to watch on TV. A good show all around, and and then now we're getting into the stretch run. This is kind of like the last back third of MLS where teams start to click in or click out or shut off or start to look out the window and say, I don't think we're going to be able to make it. It feels like there's a whole bunch of teams, especially on the West, that are kind of like really teetering right now, whether they're going to be, in and above or below. And once we get to that part of the season, is always my favorite part, because like during some of these international tournaments and player absences and injuries, that can be really tough. And now we're starting to see, I think we're going to begin to see who the real teams are that are going to have a shot at winning this whole thing or not.
I think the biggest feeling and reaction is just like, holy crap, it's August 30th. That's the biggest one. It's like, where is the world?
Is there a Kaylin Carr curse? There's an Extra Time curse. We know that. But it occurs to me that there might be a Kaylin Carr curse and that while teams would have loved to have you when they had you, that maybe afterwards it's not working out so well for them.
Wow. Yeah,
it's tough to recover.
Wow.
You know? We'll see how Barcelona does with Messi gone. And, you know.
We've seen what happened to Arsenal.
Nicholas Bittner got in one carpool with you, and it was like a tornado.
Yeah. You know Mikel Arteta comes into training every day. Kalen wouldn't have done this. This is not good enough.
Feel free to send any and all theories to the mailbag, 401-206-0MLS, extratime@mlssoccer.com. We're talking Heineken rivalry week here in a second. Lots of goals, lots of storylines, lots of disappointment for Anders on Sunday night. And, well, you just can't buy that sort of satisfaction.
Sort of silence in the group chat. It's weird
It's very strange. Two coaching changes, and then those teams played each other. So Freddy Juarez out by his own choice, it seems, at Real Salt Lake, and Mark Dos Santos out after Pamuka, and Pacific FC handled that business. So new head coaches soon to come, we think, and also a look ahead to World Cup qualifying. A reminder, live shows around every single night of World Cup qualifying. We will do spaces on Twitter. Doyle hosts those generally for the U.S. To break down the lineup. Who Greg Berhalter chose, we'll talk about a lot of that later. The decisions he has to make, and maybe
we did
what
a solid hour 47.
I love that
on the roster.
Lurking while I was packing up in L.A. That was amazing. I just want to compliment you both on that. I was like, this is like exactly what I was looking for, and I got it. So we'll give you that before the games, and afterwards, you know, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, MLSsoccer.com, the MLS app, etc. Full post game reaction after those U.S. games, and of course we talk in Canada as well as they embark on this octagon or the ocho or whatever it ends up being called down the line. MLSsoccer.com power rankings come out tomorrow. Doyle and I do our thing on Twitter Spaces at 11 a.m. Eastern every single Tuesday. That's on my handle.
Tomorrow it's coming out an hour later.
Oh, okay, good call there. All right, we'll be an hour late, but we'll be there to talk you through the top 10 and take your questions, and of course all the normal stuff at MLS Soccer as well. Doyle's weekend recap, etc. Steve Zakuani on Saturdays. Before we get into Heineken Rivalry Week, let's just give a shout-out to the winner of our Extra Time Fantasy League. Sarkar put up 115 points. He captained Maxi Morales for 28 points. And he also had Sebastian Drewsi off the bench with 14 en route to a winning week. So congratulations there. Let's jump right in, though. What's your best Heineken Rivalry Week moment? Dave, you were there. You were in the flesh. What was it?
Well, it has to be El Tráfico. I was doing my flesh. The Brian Rodriguez goal. I have a friend who has an Instagram video of my facial reaction as he's dribbling through, and then he scores, and I just shoved him because it was one of those moments you see it, and I'm sure everyone had a similar reaction at home, but the energy of the crowd, the moment, the atmosphere. I haven't been into a game with a genuine crowd for 2 years now, so this was my first one, and then we've got all these goals happening, but that moment, his ability just to destroy Sega Koulibaly. So congratulations on an MLS career, Koulibaly, and we'll see you in the future. And then roofs the shot, and there's like that half reaction at first. Did it go in? Because you can't really tell from my angle. And then you see the 32-52 just explode, and you're like, yeah, that thing's in the back of the net. And
It's one of the greatest individual goals in league history.
Well, and I have to say, so one of my great regrets in life was I've been to three LAFC games. One was LAFC San Jose, maybe four now. And they were playing San Jose, and Matias Almeida got ejected from the game. And I, being the intrepid reporter that I was on site, I followed him down the tunnel because he kept talking to see what he was complaining about. And I missed the Vela goal. And where I was standing was the corner that he scored it at. And so now I've seen the best goal in person at Bank of California Stadium. And that's all I need for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I mean, this is. There aren't a lot of people in this league who could have scored that goal. And you watch Brian Rodriguez play, and the gap between what it seems like he's capable of doing and what he has actually produced for LAFC, and you know, on loan with Almeria, is just the widest in history. Like he's a $15 million player or something like that. And he had gone to this game, I think he had 3 goals and 3 assists, and he came out of this game with one of the most spectacular goals in the league this year. I think one of the best individual goals we've ever seen in this league. And then he got a poacher's goal as well. And it felt like a turning the corner type of performance for him. Of course, it wasn't for LAFC, which I think we'll get into a little
bit. But you felt it in the building of like, yeah, without Vela, who was going to step up? And when he scored that goal and it puts them back ahead, the atmosphere, I think, was similar to what it's been in the past. And it didn't feel that way maybe coming in or in this game early from LAFC fans. There was a level of hesitancy, not from the supporter section. That thing bumps. I don't know that there's a better in the world. I'm not even kidding. I know I'm going to get in trouble. I'm wearing a Timbers jersey right now. There's no way this ends well for me. But that thing bumps and is wild to see. But from the rest of the building, it felt like a little hesitancy. Obviously, the Galaxy fans enjoying it early, all that stuff. And then that moment, I think, potentially felt like it could have shifted the season. And then they shifted it back like 10 minutes later.
What was the most impressive part of that goal for you, Kalen? Like, individually, technically, physically, what made it wow for you?
I mean, pick your part. Every single time where he fakes the shot and then back again. And then, I mean, the finish alone would have been a great goal. Just being able to roof that with this off foot. But yeah, the whole thing. And I guess it's just kind of like, he just, when you get in that zone, he just was just laying them down one after the next. And I was thinking about, you know, the Vela goal where he was doing the same thing to San Jose, or it flashed back a little bit to the Jovinko one some years back where he slaloms through, I think, all of Red Bull. And so it's just kind of like, you know, special player. And look, but you can't get over it. Like, it's almost like a cruel tale in a way, because there was that moment of release where they continue to come back and they get ahead twice, and then it was kind of all for naught. And I think Bob Bradley afterwards said it felt like a loss. And, you know, there's been times where Bob especially has seemed kind of at a loss for words of trying to figure out what is going on with this team. And for both teams, if you look at both sides of this, in the past, you look at LAFC and you say, okay, well, these El Traficos are almost outliers for them, where it was just like they were consistent, where they'd win games and they were more solid defensively. But it was just El Trafico, so just throw your hands up because it was going to be 4-3, and that's just the way these games go. But this feels different. It doesn't feel like an aberration for LAFC. It doesn't really feel like an aberration for the Galaxy as well, as far as conceding three goals. So I think both teams will walk away. I mean, Galaxy will feel better having being able to cloud a result out of this, but I think there's still some big questions as far as the back line goes. And you've got some positive answers from Rodriguez to be able to step up in a big way, and hopefully he can continue this form because they'll need him to. But it was kind of more of the same for both sides as far as leaking goals and some pretty bad defending as well.
Greg Vanney keeps saying you won't be playing if you keep doing that. So there are a couple guys on that play that might have to think long and hard about their starting spots. Doyle, what's your moment? Heineken rivalry week. What stood out?
I mean, honestly, the whole game from DC United against the Union, and partially it's because it feels like these two teams should have more of a rivalry than they do. And the reason they don't, it actually goes back to before the founding of the Union, because a lot of the guys who joined Sons of Ben and helped start the team were old members of the Screaming Eagles and the Barra Brava. So there's like real friendly ties between these two fan bases. And there hasn't been, I think because of that, and then because DC United's been so up and down and Philly has sort of steadily climbed the rankings and only last year became an elite team, there hasn't been the sort of high leverage matches between these two teams that have sort of fueled other rivalries. What happened this weekend was a high leverage match. This is two really, really good teams going at it. And to borrow Jim Curtin's post-game press conference, he said afterwards, "We haven't gotten our asses kicked like that in 3 years." DC United doing that to a Union side that's in the CONCACAF Champions League semifinals. And Hernan Losada said it at the, you know, afterwards as well. He's like, "I think we played at a different level than any team in this league can hit in this game. It was beautiful. We were like a team from a different league." And now, granted, it's overstated a bit, but go back and watch this DC versus Philly game. DC was spectacular. They were absolutely spectacular, and they ripped the Union apart in a way, as Jim Curtin said, that hasn't been seen in like 3 years. Like, We didn't see it at all from any of the teams they faced in CCL. Seeing that, I'm hoping that it is a spark, especially because the post-game press conferences were so vivid. I'm hoping that it's a spark that can ignite what I think has been kind of a dormant potential rivalry in this league.
And here are the folks at MLSsoccer.com, myself included, just blowing on the fire, just trying to grow absolutely. Those flames. We've been at this for years, baby. We will create one between DC and Philly. Kalen, before I give you mine, what stood out, man?
I'll say the late one last night. I mean, Seattle and Portland, and that one we saw in the first rivalry week edition that just completely went off the rails, which was awesome, with the 6-2 result. And so you always wanted to see how Portland was going to respond. They've had good success in Seattle over the last years. I think the record is I think they're unbeaten since, what, 2017?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I think it's wild.
It's unbelievable.
And so you wanted to see how they would respond. And you know, it was pretty cagey, I think, in comparison to past times. You sort of would expect that coming in. And then of course, Seattle was just snake bit, just could not get in front of goal. There are a couple where Rui Diaz is normally just so savvy, where he always seems to find that spot on the back post on set pieces or balls played across, where he's just, you know, he's going to end up sniffing that chance out and being in the right spot. And this one, it just seemed like he was either off or on the flat foot or whatever it might be. And then just unlucky with just hitting the post again and again and again. Also, Dairon Asprilla smashed one off the post too early on in the match. So
Anders is going to cut your mic, by the way.
Those posts, by the way, and other like the woodwork felt very rickety. You know, like you normally know what it sounds like when the ball hits a post and it's kind of solid. When it hit those, it just sounded like a bunch of metal just being slapped together. I'm like, are these things, what are these made out of? Are they going to stand? What the hell is wrong with these? But then it's Sebastian Blanc at the end, right?
Yeah.
With that little petty moment to the crowd.
Well, I'll take him as my favorite. I mean, you will talk about rivalry, like the fact that he was going at it with the crowd and like in a very, I would say, like, I just, the way he was doing it too was
just
amazing.
Just call it demonstrative.
Like, yeah, he was making sure people, if you couldn't hear him because it was loud there, you could understand what he had to say. And then also just when you look at the rivalry too, like he's been the personality. I mean, Diego Chara, of course, but he's more of the kind of like silent killer, where I feel like Sebastian Blanco is the one that gives this team kind of that personality or that edge, or where you really want to like jab and talk a little bit of that stuff. And he was doing that. And it was just a year, I think, after he did his ACL at this match. And then of course there was the moment with Williamson that did not look good in the first half, where he goes out non-contact injury. We're worried about him. So, but Blanco, I think it was kind of one of those moments where you're like, okay, yeah, he might be back right now. And then Mora as well played a big role.
See, Yeah, man.
We're all supporting you.
Hopefully he's either okay or on his path here, and we'll be back soon. I want everybody to know here, Anders says we are about 18 minutes in. It took us that long to say Ricardo Pepi's name. So here we are, baby. Ricardo Pepi, couple goals, wearing the cowboy hat right after he gets called into the U.S. national team. Can't stop, won't stop. 11 goals on the season now. He's the top American goal scorer in the league. And that Dallas-Austin game was just, I mean, it was like hallucinatory. Like, it was just crazy. The whole thing, like, wait, are they coming back? Are they really coming back? Like, how did this happen? Is Dallas going to win this one 8-0? We'll dig into that a little bit more and talk Ricardo Pepi more. But it's his time right now. It just seems like the universe is kind of lining up for Ricardo Pepi, and he is in position to take advantage of it. And I think maybe my favorite moment of the weekend was after this game, seeing him go find his family in the crowd. And reminding yourself that he's an 18-year-old kid, and there's his little sister who he's kissing on the head, and there's his mom, you know, overjoyed, giving a big hug, and his dad's there, kind of stoic, but you can feel the amount of pride that's sort of emanating out of him as their son just, like, comes good, achieves his dreams.
King of Texas.
Exactly. And he's got to keep that cowboy hat thing going. You were right, Doyle. You're a little bit on Twitter, like, that should be his thing. It's so badass, and it fits him so well.
He needs to add it to his goal celebration. He needs to somehow work something Texas in. Because now, let's be real, he's probably going to go score 25 for Barcelona next year, whoever it is. He's got to have a Texas-style goal celebration that becomes iconic around the world. So whether it's like shooters and whatever, that's the belt thing that they use.
Yeah,
just the belt.
Actually the belt thing. Yeah,
yeah, the belt buckle.
The belt buckle. The yeah, belt whatever thing? It is.
What the?
Yeah, the thing that the cowboys would put their, yeah, their firearms. Yeah.
You know the like spinny metal thing on the back of their cowboy boots, whatever that is.
Spurs. Yeah, that's I know that one. He's got to find a way to work something like this.
Does Ricardo Pepe, because we know he's going to get sold probably sometime within the next two windows, will his transfer fee break the record for an MLS homegrown that was set a couple years ago by Alphonso Davies?
This is why.
What is the number that we're saying for Davies?
This is why I should go through in the pre-rundown meeting better with you guys. It's literally in the Ricardo Pepe section. We will get there in just one second.
No. Doyle's asking questions.
No.
Doyle's hosting.
There's a rundown? What the heck?
I will say that I have looked at multiple sites for custom temporary ink, and maybe that's me copping out here, so I can have a Ricardo Pepe tattoo.
Yeah, dude, oh, God.
That's embarrassing.
No, just temporary. Yeah, no, just embarrassing. Embarrassing. Nobody would want one? Just me?
No one wants anybody a fake home? Tattoo. If you're going to do it. If you're not, don't.
Okay, that's fair. All right. Doyle, give us the playoff reset here, and now is your opportunity. Ask questions.
I think what we're seeing is in the East, the teams at the bottom of the playoff race, which are DC, Montreal, and now Philly, have separated just a little bit. Like DC's only 3 points ahead of Columbus and Atlanta, but I don't think there's a lot of argument that those teams below the line are playing as well as the teams above the line. Whereas in the Western Conference, it's just a mess. Sixth place through 11th place is separated by 3 points. Obviously, there are six teams in the hunt for 2 points. In order, it's Portland, Salt Lake, Vancouver, San Jose, Dallas, and LAFC. Most of those teams are on 21 games. The only team that's not is Dallas. They're on 22. So everybody's got a game in hand on Dallas. Like, all between 24 and 27 points. It's absurd because Portland, who are the six teams, so who are top the heap in that race, are minus 10 goal differential on the year. What is the appropriate question here besides what's going on and how much do we actually know about what's going to happen in this race?
I guess
That's the eternal question, right? Yeah. Every single Monday I get in here, I'm like, what do I actually know? Do I know anything? Like,
yeah. To me, in the West, the big question is, does anyone jump up? Yeah. Because I think the East is more scrambled to me. Like, do you believe in any of the teams outside of the playoffs to push their way in? Now, I understand everything you're saying, which is it's all chaos and it's MLS. You never know. But that, to me, is the main thought process. Does anyone either have something that I believe in that is starting to come together, whether it's Ryan Gold, Ricardo Pepe, I don't know, Brian Rodriguez, or the play for San Jose as a team since they've shifted the way they've played and brought in Obobese? That to me is like the whole question mark. And it's not like, can the playoff teams hold on? It's, is there anyone who will jump up and fight for it?
So all right, I'm going to put that question to you then.
Kalen and Andrew, because I already spoke, you guys.
Okay, there you go. Putting it to Kalen and Andrew then.
In the Eastern Conference, there are two teams I think that have the capability.
We're literally talking about the West. We're literally talking.
Okay,
about
I was about to hit the West because that's the point. In the East, it's only two. It's Columbus and Atlanta, in my opinion. From Chicago down, I'm sorry, I don't think they have it. I don't think it's going to happen for them. They're not going to be able to make up the ground, and the teams above them, really, it's DC, Montreal, and Philly, in my opinion, aren't going to drop enough points for them to get there. So this is probably a Ben Bear moment where I'm like, Chicago Fire, you're done. Miami, it's over.
Let's make a friendly bet. I bet you Miami makes the playoffs.
Okay.
What you want it to be, and then
I'll take the bet. I'm here on your terms.
All right, Anders, brainstorm for me and come back to me. We'll do it.
Wait a minute.
In the West, I think there are four teams.
Miami makes the playoffs. Who's dropping?
I don't know.
This is my favorite kind of gambling right here. Yeah. He's just absolutely shooting those six shooters. You're shooting from the hip right now.
Because that's the thing. If you look at the Eastern Conference, none of the teams above the line right now are playing poorly.
Yeah, I agree. Right?
I mean, Philly would be the closest, and because of the second leg of the CCL, they have slightly more compact schedule. but like it would take a lot for me to bet against Philly dropping. And there's a 9-point gap right now between Philly and Miami.
So the only thing I will say, though, and this is not something I'm trying to speak into existence, Montreal beat the Red Bulls on the crazy penalty kick game, and then they drew Cincinnati. Then they drew someone good, I think. And then this week, while it's great, it was against 10 men for what, 85 minutes? Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not saying I think Montreal will drop off, but I don't know that I've seen the performances from early in the year. Again, right now, Mason Toy out for a while. Kyoto just came back. So that adds a little bit, but I still think you've lost something as a team overall. And with DC, the only thing I know is it's a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. So, like, where does the season end for them? Are we on the up or are we on the down? I do think that there is room for both of those teams to drop as well.
I'm taking the bet. I'm not, as Anders has suggested, betting a Ricardo Pepi tattoo on it.
What about a Roger Robinson tattoo?
Not a big Chile guy. It's fine. I'm sure Patagonia is beautiful and all, but, like, I'm not going to go there. Whereas the Western Conference is what I was going to say. I think there are four teams that could jump, and there are at least three teams that feel like they're not on shaky ground, but could be on shaky ground. And I guess Minnesota, at some point, we've got to allow them to be on more steady ground, but beating Houston is not going to be that
Minnesota's fine.
Moment. So, yeah, I think Vancouver, San Jose, Dallas, or LAFC could all make a run, but that also is just on proximity, too. Let's get into it. Let's get into the nitty-gritty here. We'll start with our celebrating
Vancouver
soccer.
Vancouver and San Jose play each other three times still this season, which is very delicious.
That's one way of putting it. Celebrating Soccer Mode of the Weekend, presented by Cunhill Tire. El Tráfico always delivers. We've talked through this just a little bit, but I want you to take us on the ground, Dave, because you and I know that there's just something special about that match, about that stadium, about these two fan bases coming together. It may still be new in MLS terms, but it is almost at the very top of the list. I'm sorry, Cascadia folks. I'm sure you're going to claim that spot. But just give us a little idea of your day at the game.
Yeah, you know, 4 p.m. local kick, so nice sunny California day. I think, and for anyone who's going to an LAFC game, I'm sure it's open invitation. Right next to the stadium is a large field where they tailgate, and the whole supporter section's there, and there's other stuff set up as well. Shout out to Continental, who's there, and Heineken. I got him in. but, like, there's just Mexican bands playing, people making pupusas, grilling tacos, quesadillas, handing out beers, all of that. And it's one of the best atmospheres, I think. And what's always fun about this game is you have a ton of LAFC fans who were Galaxy fans. You've got a ton of Galaxy LAFC families and friend groups. And I've never seen an issue outside of in the stadium when there's like the one LA Galaxy section where it's like it feels like Galaxy fans can come and hang out pregame and enjoy the game and get excited together. So you have all of that. And then you walk in and it's this wall of noise and the black and you've got the LA Galaxy fans up in the corner, which are always incredible. And we were in the building about 2 hours before to drop stuff off and you could hear the chanting for the Galaxy fans. Like it was full, like from 2 hours before, and they maintained all the way through. So that part's always fun. And then no Vela, no Chicharito. As I was saying, I think there was a little bit of question mark. I heard people all around me talking about Vela and talking about Chicharito. And the guy behind me goes, yeah, that's Diego Rossi. He doesn't really live up to what is expected. That's Brian Rodriguez. Same. And then like an hour and a half later, everyone's jumping up and down celebrating Brian Rodriguez. So it had that playoff atmosphere. It had that intensity. And it really is one of the best games I've ever been to. This is my second. I'm calling it El Tráfico. You guys can do whatever you want. And I think it's the best MLS games I've ever been to. And it was right on par with that again. And after being away for 2 years, it was impressive that you can get right back up to that level.
It was so good that everybody else is just speechless here.
Did I just break the show?
Just everybody like, oh my God, I can't even imagine. What changed without Vela and Chicharito? And why is it that it can just weather straight through it? Like, there's other games, other matchups where if you lose your two stars and you lose sort of the, you know, the polar opposites here, it doesn't live up. But for whatever reason, whether it be through Zlatan, whether it be through Chicharito's absence, Vela's absence, et cetera, this one just doesn't stop. Why is that, Kalen?
Well, there's just a lot of quality still. I mean, you go through and Brian Rodriguez is, I mean, he showed his quality on the pitch. I just think you look all over the field, like throughout both teams, there's just good players. So it's built around. I still look, this game was fun and it was exciting, and so it was All-Star, but I still think it doesn't quite have the same juice when Vela and Chicharito aren't involved. Just that's what I want to see. But there's still enough. These teams are built well. And there's enough quality to see it through or to make it an exciting match.
Especially now.
What Goss said, yeah.
But like, while Zlatan helped, but like, this is a Galaxy team that just has options that they didn't have outside of one or two star players now. And listen, Greg, I'll text you next time. He probably didn't know I was coming to the game because Efra Alvarez should always start if I'm in the building. But he comes off the bench and his first touch is a ball over the top and he takes it down on the side of his thigh into his path. And that's off the bench. And then you've got Jovelic now up top who can run the back line, which gives Cabral space to operate. And Cabral looks just much more comfortable when he doesn't have to be a false nine or whatever position they're going to put him in. You have Revolution as well in midfield to like be able to turn and break the game so Dos Santos doesn't have to come and get the ball 100% of the time. There's just quality on that side that hasn't existed really since LAFC has been in the league. And then on the flip side for LAFC, you know, Bob would, if he could, roll out a Vegas Lights team and see if he could beat the Galaxy and be happy with it.
What'd you make of the game itself, Doyle? How did these coaches approach it?
In their typical style. Like Bob Bradley has said repeatedly over the past couple of months, like we're doing the same thing. We're playing the same type of soccer that we played in 2019 and most of 2020. And, you know, that hasn't changed. What's changed is that they're just finding ways to give up cheap goals. And that has become LAFC's MO. And if you look at that first goal that they gave up, I mean, Greg Vanney did a great halftime hit on Fox where they asked him, you know, what are you seeing from this game? And he's like, well, the first time we actually started to play the ball forward, we just put it in front of the net and they gave us a goal. And that, like, every game you can say that about LAFC. They are arguably the most mistake-prone team. If you want to look, you know, throw it back to that previous segment where we were trying to talk about teams in the West below the playoff line before Weeby decided to filibuster about the Eastern playoff race. Like, LAFC are in 11th. I think if you cut a 15-minute segment out of, like, every game they played this year, just, like, one random 15-minute segment, and you showed that, almost nobody would say this is the 11th best team in the Western Conference. They play such good soccer. And then they shoot themselves in the foot because, frankly, their defenders have not been up to the task, and their goalkeepers are not the type to bail them out. It's not Andre Blake or Matt Turner back there. For the Galaxy, I think there is a strong argument that Nick Depue is actually the best center back.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? I mean, if you look at how Koulibaly has played, he's a very good passer of the ball. He doesn't do many things correct defensively. And then, you know, Williams is just sort of all over the shop. So I think that there's a personnel issue that they have to figure out there. And then the other thing is, like, this is a Greg Vanney team. Greg Vanney teams are always going to try to use the ball and control the tempo and defend in that manner. And obviously it's working very well, but that leaves them exposed to having to make plays, individual, frankly, plays defensively when they're not able to grab a hold of the game and control the ball. And in this game, they didn't control it. Even though they had about 50% possession, I think LAFC were just constantly getting to the spots that they wanted. And so the Galaxy had to make a ton of plays, and they mostly weren't able to. But they're so good going forward, in part because Vanney is just a very gifted coach in terms of drilling kill patterns in the attack, and partly because he has done what previous Galaxy coaches never had any interest in. He has developed players like Efra Alvarez and Julian Araujo, and they signed Kevin Cabral, and right now, I mean, he hasn't been blowing the doors off in terms of productivity, but he's constantly getting into good spots, and his game, his speed opens up the field for the rest of the team. And so it was Efra to Araujo to Cabral for the equalizing goal. So it played out exactly as these two teams have been playing all year long. And it just, I mean, for LAFC, it just becomes like they have to figure out how to lock in and stop making those types of defensive errors. And for the Galaxy, I do think that it's still a personnel issue in the middle of that back line.
And I was just going to say real quick, I think Nick Depew, I agree with you. I still don't think it fixes it. Like, this is an issue. The solution doesn't exist on the roster. Credit to Greg Fanny for getting these performances out of this team. And we always knew it would take a little while to flip the roster post GBS, and it's taken to close maybe too long, maybe a really long time. It depends on how you want to see that. And I think we'll find out what Chris Klein and the Galaxy think over the next few months about that. But you watch this team play, and they are not an MLS Cup contender right now because they do not have a high level, a top 10 MLS center back, let alone top five.
For LAFC, the reason why those errors and mistakes are hurting so bad is they don't have the same goal scoring that they had in the past, because LAFC has made mistakes in the past and they take risks, and that's part of their style of play. It's part of the way that they want to build and go through phase of possession. They take risks, they press, they want to counter press. And sometimes that leaves you with some mistakes. Now, some of these are definitely curable, but they generally in the past have had the firepower to be able to stop, to overcome those big mistakes. And this team is not the same way. They are right in the middle of, as far as goals scored in the Western Conference, I think probably on the lower half. Rossi has 6 goals this year in the same amount of games that he had last year. He had 16. So he has not had the same goal scoring output. Rodriguez, of course, you know, he's come back into the team late, but these were his first 2 goals of the season. They just haven't had that same kind of, okay, doesn't really matter. Yes, the style of play, but the finishing has not been there for this team. And that's made these errors magnify. I think they've only scored more than 1 goal once or twice in the last month. So it's been the way that this team needs to win right now is by not making mistakes. And obviously that's not happening for them right now.
Dejan Jovlić, what'd you guys think of him? 2 goals in this game. He was enjoying his time. I loved him jumping up into the crowd.
Ooh, great
a little bit. Maybe got to hit the gym. Just
where is that selfie?
Yeah, I don't know. Somebody's got to produce that thing, man. That's part of the laws of the game. If you take the selfie with the player after he scores a goal, you have to publish that in a public forum. But 2 goals here, the movement. And Greg Vanney said afterwards, this is just the beginning. Like, this guy's going to score a ton of goals in this league. And this is, I mean, they had to have this with Chicharito out long term. And it, just like Carlos Hill, we'll talk about in a little bit, it still is kind of TBD on when Chicharito will be back. Anybody have any strong thoughts on what they saw from the young Serbian in this one?
Well, just opportunistic, first and foremost. He was just, you know, the best strikers are always optimistic and expecting the ball to come through and land at their feet or someone to make a mistake, and he capitalized on it well. And then the left-footed strike as well, too, was really nice to the back post. He's pretty mobile as well. He's a little quicker than you think. Finisher, obviously, but I think he's going to play really well with Chicharito. I think sometimes Chicharito thrives off movement and getting lost in the box and finding space. And we've seen in the past the Galaxy wanting to play with like a second striker if they can. And I think the two of them could actually work quite well together, because Chicharito, he comes back and will get involved in the build-up play, but that's not really his strength. Where I've seen a little more from Jovlić, where he could come back and hold the ball a bit and combine and then spin out and get movement. So, I think the two of them could play quite well together if Vanny wants to go that route.
And even if they don't, Chicharito, 1, injured now, so you needed that cover, and it's for him to have the confidence scoring. But the other is, Chicharito's not a young player. Now he's been hurt a large stretch over the last 2 years. So I think that there's probably a ton of time where they just won't be available at the same time. So you can spell them pretty simply, and you're not, as I was saying, forcing other players out of position that you value highly in a Cabral or an Efra or Grancy or whatever it is as a false nine. Victor Vasquez playing there obviously is not a long-term fix. So I think all of that just makes them a more complete roster, which now allows them to challenge over the course of a year.
Is it time to have the LAFC conversation? Do you guys want to do that?
No.
One where Bob Bradley's out of contract at the end of the year, and so is Carlos Vela, and their DPs need selling, and the results aren't coming, and it just sort of feels like there's an inflection point at some point? Or do we pump the brakes on that?
I think we pump the brakes for now, but I think that by the end of September, we'll have a really good sense of what's going to happen in the future with this team. But it certainly feels like they might have missed a window. And the decision going back to 2019, or I guess it was 2018, where they used that third DP slot on Horta instead of a number like a Rui Diaz style number nine. And then they got that one wrong. And so they went out and they got Rodriguez with that third DP slot instead of a Rui Diaz style number nine. Those were flexes. Those were like, we can do player development and win at the same time. And I think if you look back at that decision and then the decision to trade Walker Zimmerman, who, you know, best 11 center back in his prime, that was a flex. They don't look good in retrospect. They really don't. Even with the brilliant goal that Brian Rodriguez scored this weekend, I think we can all agree that LAFC would have been a lot better off the past couple of years if they had had like a 27, 28-year-old just pure goal scorer up top. Doesn't have to have any bells and whistles, doesn't have to have any sell-on value, just someone who can lead the line. And they've been kind of struggling to be the type of team that they can be since they made those two moves.
By the way, a lot of rumblings when Dave and I were in LA about either Rossi or Rodriguez or somebody getting sold before this European transfer window closes. So keep a close eye on LAFC in that sense. There was word that one of those guys was extremely close, might even thought he was going, and it didn't happen. But there's still time, so we shall see. We'll have that conversation. It's coming. There's no way to escape it. Let's keep it rolling through Heineken Rivalry Week, though. Hell is real. It was almost very real for Caleb Porter and the crew. It escaped thanks to Miguel Berry. Just, you know, if everybody knew it was going to be Miguel. That's how you save your season. Some bad news as well. Kevin Molino, hot boy. Another ACL tear. I think that's his third. It's just awful stuff. What is there to take away from this game? I mean, FC Cincinnati is taking away the same thing they've been taking away for a long time now, which is if they're not the worst team in the league, they're the second worst.
I think for Columbus, there's question marks around them, and I don't think any of that's fixed. This is a game they should win, and they probably should have won it more comfortably than the way they did. And so you're looking at a group right now that doesn't create chances the way you want them to. They're not finishing efficiently when they do, and then there are holes defensively that didn't exist in the cup run last year. And I think we haven't really discussed it that much, but Arthur has been a bigger loss than we expected because we've talked about all the injuries. And I think his ability to play both ways, to be a defensive stopper and protect the back line, huge, but he's comfortable on the ball, and I think that gives balance to what Nagby does and makes them more dangerous. Man, I'm
everybody's
on one
speechless today.
Yeah.
No, I don't disagree with any of that. What's kicking around my head is even with all the injuries and even with needing Kenneth Vermeer to absolutely bail them out this weekend.
I mean, he quite literally hands you the ball off shots. Like his rebounds are perfect for the opposing team.
He does it a lot. Even with that, part of me still feels like the crew are too talented to miss the playoffs. But I don't know if I actually believe that anymore. Because if you look at their fullback play this year, it's been pretty poor. If you look at their center back play, Mensah's not at the level he was at last year, and they really have missed Josh Williams. They, without Artur and Aiden Morris, they don't really have anyone who sort of naturally gets pressure to the ball in central midfield. That's a really bad mix right there. That's a really bad mix of things to try to compensate for. And so, you know, they badly needed this win. They almost squandered it, even though it was, you know, literally gifted to them. But it's hard to talk, despite the talent on that team, it's hard to talk myself into this result being the start of a push back up the standings, back above the playoff line and into the playoff picture.
Not a comfortable win, right? Like the way you described, which you would think when you look at these two teams coming in that they should have a much more, and I understand it's a derby game and sometimes those can go a little bit sideways, but I think the path forward, I mean, there's, for all of the things that have gone wrong, there are 3 points, what, 3 points off of DC and 5 points off of Philly, who we talked about was, you know, not in great form right now. So it's the type of team that when you look at this back half, if they can just sort of, as we've seen in the past, Sounders teams or, you know, Toronto, whoever it might be in the past, where they just need to get in the playoffs. And then when you see the form that they have, some of the formula they even have as far as set piece, we saw the goal from Zellerian, where you look at that, if they can lock things down, get some people healthy, I think they could be a team where they're, you know, even if they're not at home, which hasn't been a big, you know, place for them to find success anyways right now, they could definitely do some damage in the playoffs or not be a lower seed team if they sort of click in. So I think they find a way in ultimately.
Columbus's next 4 games at Orlando, at Miami, home to the Red Bulls, so you got to take 3 points there, and then at the Revolution, and that takes them to mid September. Like there's going to be some clarity achieved over these next couple of weeks through those 4 games for this team. As for Cincinnati, I think we had clarity achieved a couple of years ago, and it's still pretty clear the type of team Cincinnati.
Yeah, we're not going to use any time on this show to dig into FC Cincinnati. They got enough to dig into themselves. Got to figure that one out. Let's talk Timbers. They needed this win. Speaking of teams that needed one, it's been a little bit bumpy for them. They did not need Eric Williamson to go down non-contact. Mm-hmm. Again, we just hope for the best for him. Haven't heard any official news here, but the rumblings were ACL. Hope that's not true. Hope there's a quick recovery. TBD, we'll see what the diagnosis comes back as. But this was a little bit, it was both unexpected in some ways for the Sounders to fall a little bit flat, though. Look, all it takes is like 6 inches cumulative throughout this game and they win 4-2. But also their home form is not the best. 5-3-4 for a team we've been praising all year long. What did this game say about the Timbers to start? And then we'll hit the Sounders.
Who are you asking, Weeby?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I didn't know.
Does anybody got a take here?
For the Timbers, I think you saw the reaction to giving up all the goals, which was to play a little bit more condensed, to play tighter. The personnel, same as we talked about the LA Galaxy, doesn't exist defensively for the Timbers. I mean, Mabiala was all over the place in this game, and those posts are the reason that they got a result out of this one at all, because it probably should have been a loss, let alone a win, which is huge for them. Now, again, Blanco's back. He is the best player on this team, so you get a win, and you have that difference maker, and maybe the confidence is enough to start to lead this team back the other way. But there's not a single player on this back line that I trust defending 1v1 at any point. And now you take Williamson out of the group, although I will say Paredes stepped in and played pretty well off the bench.
Yeah, but he was subbed off midway through the second half as well with what looked like a knock.
Yep.
Oh, you think that was an injury? I thought that was just
the way they were. So it looked like a knock to me, and the way they were talking about it on the broadcast, it sounded like a knock.
Yeah.
So okay. I don't know how severe it is, but I will say the big difference in this game, first of all, as you said, having Blanco back, he elevates the entire team. That's one. Two was, this is a throwback performance from Diego Chara. Like he looked like 28-year-old Diego Chara, not 35-year-old Diego Chara in this one. I haven't pulled the numbers from Second Spectrum yet, but I'm actually going to do that to see if he covered more ground or just made a higher percentage of defensive interventions. And three was, even though Portland was absolutely flammable on set pieces, and it's kind of a miracle they didn't give one up, they were pretty good defensively from the run of play, from open play. And part of that was that for whatever reason, maybe they were just, you know, thinking back to it, they weren't pushing as high. The fullbacks were way less flammable in this game than they have been for most of the year.
I think it was a conscious reaction to losing 6-2.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct. And that might be how they have to play. And the thing with Portland is if they play like that, like we're just going to defend, you know, we're going to have two different teams on the field, the 3 guys we attack with and the 7 guys who we defend with and do not go forward. Like that might be how they have to play it from this point forward.
This is Groundhog Day. It's every single year. This exact time of year, we have this exact conversation where it's like, well, maybe they just got to do this. And then It's like that's where they wanted to be the entire time.
You're not wrong, but the issue is, in the past, they could do that and mostly survive, and even occasionally thrive, because they were good enough defensively. But the way this team defends or doesn't defend on set pieces, like if you bunker for a good portion of any game, you're going to give up a lot of corner kicks and probably a good amount of free kicks as well. And they just cannot defend them. So there's a great result from Portland. They're back up into sixth place. They have Blanco back. It's like the crew thing, though. It's like they have so much talent. It's hard to imagine them missing the playoffs, but they have such obvious Achilles heels that you could see a very clear path to them actually managing to miss the playoffs. And as for the Sounders, if you look back over the past month and a half, that Timbers game is an outlier. They've played 9 games since mid-July. Obviously, they won that Timbers game 6-2. 8 other games, they've been shut out 3 times. They've scored more than a single goal just once. Teams have started just sitting back against them, absorbing pressure, and daring the Sounders attack to break them down. And Seattle really, really struggle with that. And in large part, that unless Freddie Montero is out there kind of feeling, you know, 10 years younger, they only have one goal scorer. It's basically just Rui Diaz or set pieces. And this has been I wrote about it last month in the you know, Tears Revisited article. Like, this is my concern with the Sounders going forward, is that they do not have a guy who consistently puts the ball in the back of the net from open play, aside from Raul Diaz. And whether it's Christian Roldan or Nico Ladero, and really with the formation they play, it's got to be one of those two guys. They have to figure this out, or they are a much less dangerous team than they've appeared to be throughout most of this 2021 season.
Kalen muted himself.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Maybe that's what it's been this whole time. You guys have just been muted. Just, you know, going out the empty air. It's just a lot of people trying to jump in at the same time.
Kalen, I agree with you. That's a really strong
exactly.
point.
Exactly. I fully impressive. 100% agree. Not still not no nothing. Don't give us a test here. Wow, just say
you are
1, 2, 3.
One of the great soccer minds of our generation.
Nope, it's gone. We will wait for Anders to tech support here as we continue on. Our 2222 player of the weekend presented by Body Armor. Who else? Ricardo Pepi. Him and his buddy Jesus Ferreira tore Austin apart. Looks like it was going to be even more lopsided than it was. This was just a crazy game. It was super entertaining to watch. It was also pretty poor from a defensive standpoint for large stretches. But you know what? As a neutral, I don't care about that. I want to see Ricardo Pepi scoring goals and putting on cowboy hats. That's what I want to see. Let's just run this whole Ricardo Pepi week back and start to ask the questions I think you started to ask, Doyle, beforehand, because it seems like this is going to be a short-term stay for Ricardo Pepi in Major League Soccer. Like, that's just kind of the way that the transfer market works.
Well, 3+
but the record for goals in a season by a teenager is 13. I remember that season by Diego Fagundes. I believe I was there for a couple of those at Red Bull Arena. Fagundes was on the field. He scored in this game. Well, Pepe's up to 11. He's going to break that record almost certainly. We had John Parker over at Soccer Ventures saying, for Soccer Ventures saying, it's reasonable that with Pepi on a new contract, remember he just signed that, for Dallas to ask foreign bidders to break Alphonso Davies' mark for the highest transfer for an MLS homegrown. And Taylor Twellman's out here saying, I'd play Pepi ASAP with the national team, not kidding. Like, where is the Pepi hype train at right now, Doyle? Like, what station are we in?
an expensive one. You know, he's clearly established himself as the best center forward on that team. I don't think there's any question about that at all. He's not only scoring consistently for Dallas, he actually opens up the game pretty consistently with his movement, and I think his link play is getting better. He earned this U.S. national team call on merit, just like he earned the starting job with Dallas on merit. And if you look at his career in terms of goal scoring, every time he's gone up a level, he has still figured out how to put the ball in the back of the net. And it's because he has those Mondo instincts, right? If you look at him play in the box, he's either He's always either creating space or finding space, and he's just a pure ball striker as well. So that's one. But two is his improvement curve at the other stuff over the course of the year has been really impressive. And why I think it's reasonable to talk about, okay, this kid is probably maybe going to break the record for a homegrown transfer fee heading out of MLS. He's a pure goal scorer, proven at a good level, who is 18 years old, already an international from an academy that now has a reputation for producing guys who can play in the top five leagues in Europe. I don't think he's an elite athlete, but he's clearly a good enough athlete to start in a top five league. The hype train is exactly where it should be, and that's where everyone is realizing it's not hype. It's legit with this kid. It's the eye test and the box score numbers. The underlying numbers aren't quite there yet, but if you look at how he moves in the box and how he makes the FC Dallas attack better, I think the underlying numbers will catch up as well. And he's now about to face two of the biggest tests of his life. Can you contribute in World Cup qualifying and sort of help right the wrongs of Kuva? And can you help push Dallas over the line and back into the playoffs? Because, yeah, he's a young kid, but he's also a starting center forward, and it's a job. And his job is to go, once he gets back from World Cup qualifying, his job is to go out there and be the number nine who leads the team. And how he handles that pressure is going to tell us a lot about how he's going to handle the pressure of wherever the next stop is. And just for the record, I want it to be Dortmund after they sell Holland, so that, we could have Borussia America, and it'll be Pepe and Reyna together. And I think they got another U.S. kid in that academy as well.
And for anyone wondering why this is the convo, it's not just that Pepe's good. Attacking players cost money. And a lot of the players that MLS has sold over the last few years have been center backs, fullbacks, and central midfielders, less attacking midfielders. And so the price goes up when a guy puts the ball in the back of the net. That's just natural. And so that's why it seems pretty obvious that Pepe, with a pro goal scoring track record at his age, will be pushing that Alphonso Davies number. I think it's unquestionable that you're talking double digits in the, or sorry, seven. How many digits is
eight?
Okay. Eight digits. Yeah. Eight digits. It's unquestionable that he's going to push that number. Is it Alphonso Davies? I don't know. One of the things that will be interesting is, so let's say he comes in and plays with the U.S. national team over this qualifying cycle and gets minutes. Is that enough to push that? Or with this new contract, does Dallas talk to him and say, come back and be comfortable next year in MLS if he is still getting call-ups, so that you set yourself a stage to go to the World Cup? And because of that weird timing, can Dallas have him for a season and then sell him off the back of a World Cup, which is probably the peak of his value coming out of this league right now?
David Goss, thinking like a GM, auditioning for a couple open jobs around the league.
Listen,
right now.
Oh, hey. I promise you this one thing. I won't sign Kenneth Vermeer in goal.
Kenneth Vermeer catching a stray, which is the only thing he's caught for a while.
Oh, my Lord. All right. You like transitioned as well. We have plenty of time to talk Ricardo Pepe, because it's not going to end for us. Of course, we'll see where he is for Greg Berhalter coming up against El Salvador. Maybe in a starting lineup. Probably not, but we shall see. Speaking of those GMs, Jeff Carlisle saying multiple sources telling ESPN that the following candidates have been in contact with the Quakes about their vacant GM job. You have recently hired sporting director for the Sounders, Craig Weibel, previously at Real Salt Lake. You have DC technical director, Stuart Mares. You have technical director in Philly, Chris Albright, and then, of course, Chris Leach. And then also Will Kuntz, who's at LAFC and was at the league office before that. I remain on record saying that Leach is going to get this job, but we shall see. All those guys have real track records to them, and certainly a lot of MLS experience, which would make sense for the Quakes to go after. But bigger news here, as opposed to just guys trying to get a job, two lost their jobs, or one gave one up, I should say. Freddy Juarez out, Mark Dos Santos out. That was a busy Friday in MLS coaching circles. Where do we want to start? We want to talk Freddy? Because they played then, and then the Caps slapped RSL down. But let's start with Freddy, because the reporting came out, and Sam Stachkol is all over this, Tom Bogert as well. But Sam, he basically is the most perfect positioned person possible to report this story, given his connections to Real Salt Lake, as well as Garth Lagerwey, et cetera, et cetera. Apparently, Freddy's going to go be an assistant coach for the Seattle Sounders. And some people are saying, well, that doesn't make sense. He was a head coach. Why would he do that? Well, he would do that because it seems like his tenure as RSL head coach would be ending probably at the end of this season. No matter what they did, and also because that situation is inherently unstable. I mean, they don't have an owner right now. They're trying to figure out that aspect of it. We all understand that story, and that introduces uncertainty. So I get it from Freddy Juarez's perspective. He's saying job security, best team in the league. Maybe I don't actually love some of the duties that come with being a head coach as well. I'd rather just be a soccer guy, which is what I've always been. And he decides to go to Sounders. Now, that's not official yet, but again, the reporting is very, very credible. Here, I won't even call this a rumor in this case. I would call it a report. What do you make of Freddy Juarez saying adios? And then his team really sort of like laying down in the aftermath. Because the quotes afterwards were pretty tough from like Rusnak, from Glad. I mean, it seemed like it was a pretty big shock to them. And certainly their performance spoke to that. But Freddy just saying adios.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is that there's going to be a new owner next year. And with a new owner, things always get turbulent. You know, Sam's reporting is that 2022 is an option year. I assume that what happened is Freddie, you know, walked into the front office and said, pick up my option or I walk. And they said, okay, walk. And then you made a very good point, Weeby, I thought, is that right now, I mean, if you're thinking about stability between, you know, being a RSL head coach with an unpicked up option or Sounders top assistant, that's an easy choice. The Sounders are much more stable right now.
And even in 3 years, if you still want to be a head coach someday, like what's going to set you up better in the next 3 years to get an MLS head coaching job?
Yeah. And the other big part just individually is it's also being hired by two guys you've worked for.
Yeah.
So it's not, while it's a new market for him, it's not a complete unknown on that personal level.
Yeah. So it's, I get it. It's weird, but it's a really weird situation with RSL. Like everything's in flux. Everything could look different for this team next year. I think it says something about Freddy Juarez, the way that the RSL players kind of just, you know, laid down this weekend without him. I really wanted him to be for this team what like Jim Curtin has been for Philadelphia, or what Oscar Pereja was for Dallas a decade ago. He didn't quite hit that level though. You know, I know RSL were competitive, but they didn't really develop a lot of the young players. Their style of play under Juarez was pretty miserable. So I can't, this ends up making a lot of sense to me.
It makes sense
all
for
the
everybody
on the table.
It makes sense for everybody. Yeah. I mean, RSL gets it. If they weren't happy with his performance, especially in sort of game management and tactical switches and protecting leads, and they were going to move on anyway, I mean, it's okay to do so now. You're in the playoffs, but I mean, I'm sure they'll bring, like, you know, they have Pablo Mascherini on their bench for a reason.
Right.
You know, and look, Pablo did not cover himself in glory in this one as well, so that's a big question mark. Still, they have Hamison Olivi waiting back in the wings.
Yep.
You know, they have guys that they have faith in to come in and perhaps do this job. And for Freddie, I mean, I get it. Stability, going to the best organization in the league, arguably, the best assistant coach job in Major League Soccer, almost certainly. I mean, it all makes sense for everybody involved, and so there you go. Now, you said it, Dave, before this Pacific Voyagers Cup game for the Whitecaps. Watch out for Pablo Ducas' boys. Well, Vancouver had been on an unbeaten streak in MLS, but that did not extend. And then Mark Dos Santos lost his job on the back of that. And I think he was probably in a similar situation to Freddy, which is a little bit of a lame duck, right? His contract was up. Yeah. Big question mark as to whether they were going to pick that option up.
I don't.
And in the end, the decision was to make the decision now.
Yeah. And I get it. And first of all, it breaks new ground for the Canadian Championship, because I think this is the first time in the history of that competition that a coach has been fired for a terrible performance in the Canadian Championship.
Shout out to the CPL making history.
Right. But it's like, I feel bad for, because Mark DeSantis has always seemed like a completely decent guy to me. And I thought he was going to be a really good MLS coach. He was really good with NASL, with that San Francisco Deltas team in 2017. And then Swope Park was what they were called at that time in 2016 with Sporting KC. Those teams were good. They were well coached. I thought it was going to translate in MLS, and it never did. It never did. So I think that given that, and given his struggles to frankly get the most out of the roster, and given the week to week inconsistency with not just formations or personnel, but like principles of play, it was never there for the Whitecaps in 3 years. And now, granted, the last two have been really hard, and granted, the personnel in Dos Santos' first year was not good, but he was the one who was in charge of picking that personnel. So it's tough to give him too much of a pass. And then for the team to go out the day after he's dismissed and perform, or the weekend after he's dismissed, and perform like they did against RSL on Sunday night, you get it. But I don't think Mark Dos Santos will be out of a job long. I suspect that he will have a top assistant job somewhere real quick, because he's shown in the past. He worked under Bob Bradley and Peter Vermees, were two of the best respected coaches in the league. I don't think he will be looking for very long. I'm very curious to see what both of these teams end up doing to replace these guys in the long term.
And I think, what I remember, if I'm right, about the comments coming out of Vancouver was that MLS experience wasn't key. It was more alignment on style of play, how you want to build a team, how you want to use assets and resources to build the roster. I think that's a mistake, obviously, from our Atlanta United conversations over the last, 3 years? No, sorry, 3 weeks, whichever one we've been doing. And obviously, I made the point last week about Pamo Odukas team, which is made heavily out of former Vancouver Whitecaps players, which has taken CPL by storm, plays an attacking style, young players who are performing at their highest level, and a guy who used to play for Vancouver and has won in MLS. And so it would be amazing to me if the Whitecaps found a way to not pick Pamo Odukas for this position, which I've been amazed by MLS teams since I started watching. So it would be nothing new.
I would hope that he'll get an interview at the very least, because he has that team playing well. And to your point about that Pacific FC roster, guys like Kaden Jung, Marcos Bustos, who was so good as a youth player. These are, look, man, 7-8 years ago, if you had asked people who really follow the USSDA at that point, what it used to be called, it's now MLS Next, which is expanded and different, but it's essentially the same thing. The top developmental academies in North America, they would have told you Vancouver was on par with, you know, FC Dallas and the Galaxy and the Union, and, you know, like at that elite level. And they had all these players come through, and what they never had was a coach in the first team who would filter them up through the system and into the 11 and do the type of things that Greg Vanney is doing now for the LA Galaxy. Do the type of things that have been part of the culture for FC Dallas since Oscar Pereja got the head coaching job. They've never had that. And it kind of breaks my heart. I'm happy for the kids with Pacific FC who played so well and, you know, doing so well with a, you know, very good team in that league, but like on a different timeline, in a different slice of the multiverse, a bunch of those kids are starters for the Whitecaps right now. So I'm glad to hear Axel Schuster saying, like, we want to have that alignment. We want to make sure that, you know, Michael Baldissimo, Pat Metcalf, Habibula, the 17-year-old kid I love that they have in their academy. Well, he's technically on the first team, but Dos Santos barely played him. Like, I want to, like, the Caps have to get that right. And they have the amount of talent in that local area, and they have these satellite academies across the country, which is how they found Alphonso Davies in the first place. They have to get that right. That is step number one, because that is their path to becoming a team that can compete for titles in this league.
Schuster said it. He wants this team down the line to be all Canadian, basically, and hopefully all homegrown in a way. We'll see if they can get there. That sounds like a pretty lofty goal, but change has come to Real Salt Lake and the Vancouver Whitecaps. Before we hit real quick,
all homegrown and all Canadian and Ryan Gold. Because this guy, he's really good.
That's working out for them so far. Biggest win of week 22 before we get out of here. Quick riffs. You know what? We got to start NYCFC because I know those fans and I know how they approach Twitter, and they're borderline abusive when we don't talk about the blue side of New York. It is a lot. They come after you, okay? 2-0 against New England. That's a big win. Now, no Carlos Hill. No Tejan in this game. Carlos Hill is back. We see the images coming out this morning, Monday morning, from the training ground. He is all smiles, whether or not he's recovered from a groin problem or has just been hanging out in Spain to get his legs right for the last month or so. We don't know. Nobody's told us. We'll keep guessing. But that could be a big change for New England. But what did this game signify for the blue side of New York? And can we get a test from Kalen Carr?
Yo, am I still here?
Oh, hello. Ooh. Oh,
Kalen at the back of the subway station, just calling it forward.
NYCFC this weekend, 2-0 against New England. What's it say about that team?
That they're for real. I mean, look, you can't just go ahead and say, okay, well, no Carlos Hill, so that doesn't really matter, because they've been running through teams without him for a little while now. And Tejan, yeah, that's big. But NYCFC, I think... you know, they got Castellanos going real good now. I think he's got his 10th on the season, hit double digits, 2 in this one. He's getting these multi-goal games, which I think, you know, and I had to sit through the Pepe conversation and get to talk about it, but he's got a bunch of those. Which also really generally means that a striker is informed, because it's not just one, you're getting two, and you can kind of build off that. And then important also just to notice, like, how crucial Maxi Morales is for this team. And, you know, both goals, actually. And I think it does also give a little bit of a question mark about where we've questioned New England and said, do they have an elite center back pairing, or is that enough? Or do they have an elite defensive midfielder pairing, and is that enough? Because Maxi was able to get into those spots where Farrell and Bell are wondering, do they step? They both step at the same time, and then the ball goes over the top to Tati and is able to finish it there. And I just think, without those pieces around it, then maybe it starts to expose a couple weaknesses here and there. But an informed Tati and Maxi really being kind of the brains of the operation, because both of those goals were well taken, but they were both put on a platter with both very different and difficult types of balls.
Tied for second in the East now, our NYCFC. Why can't I do the math right here? No. Okay. Orlando and Nashville. NYCFC 1 point back, but starting to round into form. And they have games in hand.
Why do you have to do math? The standings are in order.
You know, after I got so stuck in and quote unquote filibustered the East, it was inevitable that I was going to butcher these standings at some point. How about Nashville, though? It's shocking and incredible to me that this is their first road win of the season in Atlanta.
Well, they've barely played on the road.
Yeah.
They've had seven other games, couldn't get the job done. For the team sitting third in the Eastern Conference to just now have their first road win, I mean, it speaks to the undefeated form at home. But it also speaks to sort of where that middle of the pack is in the Eastern Conference, where basically everybody from 2 till 7 are bunched within 5 points of each other.
They are, but I look, Nashville played pretty well in this one, and they were very opportunistic. They did a good job of identifying how ragged Atlanta's lines were, and then, you know, Hany Mukhtar created a chance from there, and then like 2 minutes later, Lovitz got into that same gap between the lines and Fed Rios, and that was, you know, pretty much the ball game. I do think it's, you know, they're clearly a playoff team. I do think they're a level below NYCFC in Orlando. I know they're right there with them in the standings, but the reason they're right there with them is because they've played 13 of their 17 home games already. They've only played 8 on the road. And if you look, I think 6 or 7 of their next 9 are away from Nashville. It's a lot, and they're going to have to show the ability to keep grinding out wins like this on occasion, more likely just grinding out a point. And they've done pretty well at that. They really have, but their place in the standing still does flatter them a little bit. The thing that I'm optimistic about for them is I think they figured some stuff out in terms of the formation. And I think that very clearly their best formation is that 3-4-1-2 with Mukhtar as more of a second forward than a playmaker. Let the game go through when, you know, Dax and Godoy are healthy and rested. Let the game go through them and with Leal sitting a little bit in front of them, being more of a playmaker who will also drop back and do some dirty work. You're getting plenty of width from the wingbacks. You have a little bit more defensive solidity because of the three. You're not as dynamic in the attack, but that's okay, because as long as you're possessing the ball a little bit deeper, then you can do what you did against Atlanta. Pull the opposing team up, create those gaps between the lines, and then do work from there. So I do think that they have some solutions, but we need to see more of it over the course of this long road trip that they're essentially on. I mean, they're on a road trip essentially from here on out to end the season.
Just because we're kind of at the end of the season where I feel like finally I can like look at schedules and sort of try to predict. They come home for NYCFC, and then that first road stand, as Doyle said, it's at Montreal, at Toronto, at Inter Miami, at Chicago before they come back.
And then they have another home game against, I believe, Orlando.
Yeah.
And then it's like four more on the road.
And one of them is against FC Cincinnati. So you get those points.
So this is, you get the Toronto points too. But like this is it. They're going into the blender right now. This is the wood chipper part of the schedule for Nashville SC. And like, I like their chances to come out of it on the other side, looking like a playoff team. I will be somewhat surprised if they're still top four in the Eastern Conference.
What was the quick evaluation of Gonzalo Pineda's first in charge?
It looked like the same thing going forward that they've been doing under Rob Valentino, but I think that they got so eager to get on the ball and try to impress him that they forgot about being compact defensively and basic defensive rotations. And they smelled the goal from the first minute. They smelled the goal and they went forward with reckless abandon, and they eventually just got so ragged that Nashville cut him up. And they still gave themselves a chance. If Joseph's header is on target late in the game, they at least walk away with a point. But if you looked at Gonzalo Pineda's post-game quotes, he listed all the things that he was happy with. There was not a word about defense in there. He was not happy with defense. If you want to read between the lines or interpret what he was actually saying based upon what he did not say, they're going to spend they're going to have a long week in training of probably drilling team shape in transition defense and in set defense.
Also, I was just going to say off the field also, and this is not the reason they signed Gonzalo Pineda. The point is to win games. But there's a chance that they could reach a new level because of now the interest from the Mexican-American and Mexican market, because he was the darling of the Univision and 2DN broadcast. He is a Liga MX legend. He's a Mexican international. While they've had Jürgen Damm on the roster, that hasn't really been a connection that they've had. And so I think he actually has a chance to elevate this club if he's able to be successful.
I already see the likes of Felipe Cardenas and others loving the fact that training is open. Always good for journalists. Open training, and they will literally do your bidding. All right, before we get out of here, a reminder, live shows on Thursday. That's because World Cup qualifying starts. It's incredible that it's already here. We've been talking about it for a year and a half / 4 years probably at this point. But we're here. Match day one, September 2nd, 4 games. Canada-Honduras at BMO Field. U.S. going to Estadio Cuscatlan in San Salvador to take on El Salvador. Mexico hosts Jamaica at Azteca, and Panama at Romel Fernandez in Panama City hosting Costa Rica. Let's just start with the U.S., who also in this window are going to host Canada at Nissan Stadium in Nashville, and then they're going to go to Honduras in San Pedro Sula to Olimpico Metropolitano to take on Catrachos. How many points? How many points do they need? There's not a lot of beef over this roster. You guys did your roster breakdown. What will you be happy with, satisfied with when we come back, whatever it is, at the end of September 8th, that evening? Doyle, the U.S. needs this many points for you to strike a positive tone.
Positive tone is 7. Right? Like, okay, We're in really good shape. Satisfied and not panicking is 5. Four is, you know, okay. I mean, the thing is, I would almost rather have 5 than 6. If it provided it's draw, win, draw, because win at home, draw on the road is always been the key to qualification. And it would almost be better to deny, you know, both El Salvador and Honduras, the full 3 points, than it would be to beat one of them and, you know, lose the other so that either Honduras or El Salvador are, you know, pristine at home. But I'm strongly hoping for 7 points. I think the talent is there. I know there's a lot of inexperience in this side, but you know, it's the talent matters. It really does. And we saw it in the Gold Cup, and we saw it in the Nations League. And these guys should be ready and confident to bring that to bear over the next week. And if they don't, it's going to be some very interesting shows for you to listen to while on vacation, maybe.
7 feels like a good number to me. I think you'd expect them fresh going into the first match on the road and being tested as they have been throughout the summer. They should be ready for this first one to try and take 3 points versus El Salvador. You got to win the game at home, and then you go on the road, tough turnaround, probably see some rotation throughout of the roster. But Noah Elis, I think, is that right? He's not going to be available for Honduras. Correct. He's such a big part of what they do. I think that will help the U.S. going there into the last match. But that's all, going to Honduras is always going to be just a tough fight. But I do think the guys are up for that for at least a point. If they can get 3, then, yeah, we're all greedy and just off to the races. But I think 7 should be the goal.
Maybe I'm still a little too shell-shocked or whatever, where if they draw, win, and lose in this window, I don't think I'll be upset. But that's just me.
That's probably a reasonable take. But I think that more people would be upset at 4 points than satisfied with 4 points.
When does reasonable come into the conversation with USMNT Twitter?
The really interesting thing is going to be how John Herdman approaches this, because Canada have a lot of talent in that first 13 or 14 players on the roster. But with these 3-game windows, you're going to have to see way more rotation than we've seen in past World Cup cycles. And I think this is where the U.S. advantage should be telling, because even with the injuries that the U.S., that Greg Berhalter is dealing with in the pool, you could put together 3 really good lineups for these games where nobody plays more than 180 minutes. Canada can't do that. So I'm wondering if Herdman's plan is to go all in on the 2 home games that Canada has in this window, and then essentially field the B teamers and try to smash and grab, play much less expansively against the U.S. than we saw out of Canada in the Gold Cup a month and a half ago. How he manages that, and really how every manager in the region handles that use of depth over these 3-game windows, is going to be fascinating. And it's where Greg Berhalter and Tata Martino have, a massive advantage over basically every other coach in the region.
So I don't 100% agree with you. I think Canada has more flexibility now that Atiba is back in the team. There's more flexibility at goalkeeper than they've had. Because you can trust Maxime Crépeau at this level. Alistair Johnson gives you a ton of flexibility along the back line. Where do you even play Tejan? I think you can rotate Jonathan David out of the team with Kyle Larin there, although we don't know if Cavallini's healthy. The whole conversation, though, with him, for me, comes down to Alphonso Davies. When and where do you play him? So I think the rest of the roster, you can pull Atiba out and you still have the midfield you had in Gold Cup. You can bring Atiba back in. You can play Samuel Piet. I think whether that's, is that at the US because you're trying to hang on for a point? Is that home to El Salvador because you think you have enough in the attack that you'd rather just have him sit? Whatever it is, I think they do have some flexibility, but the whole thing hinges on when and where do you play Davies over the course of this week.
So I disagree. It hinges on that defense because they don't have depth or flexibility in the defense.
They have five wingbacks / fullbacks on this team.
No, I'm not talking about the fullbacks.
Yeah, understood. Their center backs suck. The question is, can you play Danielle Henry? But outside of Kamal Miller, they all kind of suck. So you're like,
I disagree with that assessment, but they're not great. It's definitely not the strength of the team.
Also, rotating big center backs, marks. That's a space where you could probably lean on some guys and get you through it.
Who starts for the U.S. up top? One name. How about this? Who plays the most minutes? Who plays the most minutes for the U.S.?
Josh Sargent. Yeah.
How many minutes does Ricardo Pepi get?
50 in the whole week.
Yeah, I hope we have three like commanding leads, and so he's able to come off the bench three times and get, you know, 65 minutes.
But if we don't, that might even be more for him. Like to Doyle's point from the beginning of the show, he is not here because he's a dual national or a novelty. He is one of the three best available center forwards in the pool. And I think he is the most goal dangerous one right now. So if you are tied or losing and you need a goal, Ricardo Pepi makes the most sense to come off the bench in that spot. There's, it feels like a very low chance he starts a game, which I think makes sense. But even if PFOC doesn't start, I still think Pepi is the better, we need a goal late player to bring off the bench.
Who starts in goal or who plays the most minutes again, Kaylin, in goal?
I think it's probably Matt Turner. Just if you look at the summer results, all three goalkeepers did quite well. But I would say Turner has been in the best form and the best form as of late recently. So I couldn't really complain if either option. I don't think Horvat is probably going to be, in that mix. But I couldn't complain if either option were taken. But I would probably bet on Turner getting the nod.
All right, it starts Thursday, September 2nd, this Thursday. We've been waiting. We've been building up. We've been analyzing every roster, every game, every nook and cranny of the U.S. and Canada for a long time now, and this is it. It's money time. Doesn't matter what you did if you can't get to the World Cup. That is the ultimate prize, and it is one that both are chasing because they haven't had it in a hot second. Canada, a little bit longer. The U.S. coming off that CUVA disappointment. I hope someday we retire those five letters in succession. We don't have to say CUVA anymore, but we are not yet at that day. CBS Sports Network and Paramount Plus has the U.S. game. That's at 10 p.m. Eastern on Thursday night. Of course, we'll be there before, breaking down Canada's game against Honduras, as well as the U.S. roster on Twitter Spaces. Doyle will have that on his handle, at MattDoyle76, and then afterwards, all across the MLS Network, Twitter, Facebook, MLSsoccer.com, the MLS app, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So tune in for those. We'll do them for all of these games, all of these windows. Should be a good time. I'll listen in on vacation. We're going to skip the mailbag today, and you'll see us on Thursday, everybody, 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com. We always love those hot take texts
but
during
shout
US
out,
games.
Shout out to Ben Reek or Reich on from the mailbag. We appreciate
He'll know.
You.
Yeah. He'll understand? Okay, yeah. Perfect. All right, we're out of here. We'll see you later, everybody. Enjoy your week. We'll be right back.